We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpis. A reminder to check out some of the new features available on Muse. If you're like me and struggle with getting a good night's sleep, check out the digital sleeping pill. It's an intuitive sleep guide that comes with the next generation of Muse S and responds to your brain activity to help you quiet your busy mind and lull you into a more restful sleep. And even better, it can help you fall back to sleep when you wake up in the middle of the night. There's also many other new features and types of content intended for you to explore. Check it out at choosemuse.com. Today's guest is Shauna Shapiro. Shauna is a best-selling author, professor, clinical psychologist, and internationally recognized expert in mindfulness and self-compassion. She spent two decades studying the benefits of mindfulness and compassion, publishing over 150 papers, and writing three critically acclaimed books. Her TED Talk, What You Practice Grows Stronger, has been viewed over 3 million times. Her latest book, which we talk about today, is called Good Morning, I Love You, and encompasses the full range of practices that help us to grow both our meditation and self-compassion practices. I think you'll find it interesting to learn how she decided to name the book. Now, here's Shauna. Shauna, it is great to have you on Untangle today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. So I want to start with a question that I usually start with, which is, what originally inspired you to do the work that you do? And more specifically, what led up to your writing of this book?
That's a big question. So what originally inspired me to do this work was my own personal journey. I discovered mindfulness and meditation at one of the lowest points in my life. I was 17 years old and I had scoliosis. And basically, within a week, the doctor told me that I had to have emergency surgery because my scoliosis had gotten so severe, it was about to puncture my lungs. And so overnight, I went from this healthy, active teenager. I was captain of the volleyball team and had just signed to play at Duke University, to lying in a hospital bed, unable to walk. And it was during that period, I was in a hospital bed for 6 months, where I really hit bottom. I was never going to play volleyball again. That was clear. I wasn't sure I was going to walk again without pain. And all of these fears about the future and what was going to happen and regrets about the past. And I was really tormenting myself. And it was during that time that I was introduced to mindfulness, and it offered this pathway out and forward, that there was a possibility I could be happy again. And that was my entree. And when I recovered some years later, I ended up going to Thailand and Nepal to study in the monasteries there. I was really intrigued by this 2,500-year-old practice, that even just the little bits of it that I had understood through all the books I'd read, I could tell was quite powerful. And it was my experiences there in the monastery that really inspired me to come back to the US and get my PhD and spend the past 20 years studying mindfulness and meditation scientifically, because what I experienced at the monastery, and it still feels a bit magical, and I'm a scientist, so I say that tongue in cheek, but there was a moment where I realized that I wasn't in pain. And it was the first time in 2.5-3 years since my surgery that I hadn't been in pain. And my mind was completely at ease and at peace. And nothing had changed in the outside world. I was just sitting there silently watching my breathing. And it was such a radical moment. And it wasn't that I was never in pain again. And it wasn't that it was this cure-all, but that it was possible. That's what intrigued me. And so I've spent the last 20 years studying mindfulness and meditation in different patient populations, working with women with breast cancer and patients with cardiovascular disease and veterans and high-level executives and stressed-out college students, lots of different people. And what the research shows is that mindfulness is good for us. Again, it's not a cure-all, but in general, it reduces stress. It helps you sleep better. It creates more happiness and more sense of connection and belonging. And my intention for writing this book, to answer your second question, was to really start to translate it, to translate both the science and also the practice, because the practice of mindfulness, while it's become quite popular, is more complex than it's often introduced as. And I think when we simplify it, it can lose its radical transformational power.
You talk a lot about mindfulness being transformative, and in your life, it was there for you when you hit rock bottom. What is it about mindfulness? I mean, what made you believe that mindfulness tools would help you heal? And it sounds like you assign a lot of weight to mindfulness helping you heal versus maybe time passing. How did you make that decision, or what made you believe that it was mindfulness that was helping you learn to cope with even like the most horrendous pain, for example?
So a couple of things. One, I really don't believe that time passing heals things. I think how you relate to the pain or the trauma or whatever experience you've had is what's essential. That one of the most important things that I study is neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity is this understanding that the brain changes through experience, and that repeated experiences shape our brain. And there's one of the key phrases that I use in my book is, what you practice grows stronger. So if you've had pain or trauma, and then you keep engaging in the same pathways, no matter how much time goes by, you're actually just reinforcing that. That the only way that we heal and change is through doing something different. And for me, years had gone by since my surgery, and it wasn't until I started practicing in a different way and relating to my pain in a different way that it started to shift. But that was just experience. So the reason that I can tell you with a little more gravitas is that I've been studying it scientifically. And one of the main populations that we've worked in is people who experience chronic pain. And what the research shows is that mindfulness practice, and I want to get into this a little bit, what mindfulness practice is in a moment, but mindfulness practice significantly decreases pain. And in those patients where they said it actually didn't reduce my pain, it significantly increased their ability to function in daily life. So their ability to go back to work or to carry their children. What I would say is that the research has shown that there's something quite powerful specific to mindfulness, not just to the passage of time. And here's where I'll just explain that I keep using the word mindfulness.
I was going to ask how you distinguish between mindfulness and meditation as it relates to chronic pain, for example, or neuroplasticity.
Exactly. So I want to be a little more nuanced. So mindfulness is a larger umbrella term. And mindfulness is really about being present. It's a way of being, a way of paying attention. Meditation is the practice or the exercise that you do to train your mind. So I like to think of mindfulness as mental fitness, and meditation is like going to the gym, and we're exercising the mind in various ways to develop greater wisdom, greater compassion, greater focus, greater creativity. And there's hundreds of different meditation practices, just like when you go to the gym, there's hundreds of different machines to build our muscles. And each one does things a little bit differently and creates different pathways in the brain and nervous system. So mindfulness, the way that I define it, is through three key elements. And these are intention, attention, and attitude. So intention, attention, attitude. And intention is really why you're paying attention. What's important to you? What is your aspiration? What is your goal? What do you care about? And intentions really, they set your compass. They say, this is the direction you want to head. And what's interesting about your intention is that they're psychological. My intention could be, I want to be a more present mother, or I want to be a more patient teacher, or whatever it is. But when we set an intention, even if it's just, I want to exercise more, it's not just psychological, it's actually neurochemical. When we set an intention, it releases dopamine. And this is the neuromodulator of motivation and learning. And it basically stamps down to the rest of the brain and nervous system, this is important, pay attention. And so when we set our intention, it really guides us, this compass that's directing us in the right direction. So that's the first element of mindfulness. The second element is our attention. And this is about focusing our attention in the present moment. So for those of you listening right now, it's been 5 or 10 minutes here, and you may have noticed that your mind has wandered. That's okay. That's normal. In fact, research shows that the mind wanders on average 47% of the time. So what we're doing here is we're trying to learn how to bring it back and refocus in the present moment so that we can give all of our attention, all of our resources to what's important. And right now, if you're listening to this, this is what's important to you. And so our attention, I believe, is our most valuable resource. And the beauty is that we can train it, that we don't just have to leave it up to chance whether or not we're present. And the third and final element of mindfulness is our attitude. And our attitude has to do with how we pay attention, paying attention with kindness, with curiosity, and really with a sense of openness, where instead of constantly judging or evaluating, we're really trying to see things clearly without judgment, without our preconceived ideas. We're listening with an open mind. And so this third element is really quite important. It seems simple, paying attention with kindness, but I want to explain the science behind it. So often we're paying attention in a very judgmental way. I like this. I don't like this. We're judging other people, and most often we're judging ourselves. And when I started working with different patients, I was really shocked by the tremendous amount of self-judgment, not just in some people, but in everyone. People from all different walks of life, from the veterans to the high-level executives to the stressed-out college students, there is this tremendous sense of, I'm not doing it. I'm not good enough. There's something wrong with me. And as they were speaking, I knew what they were talking about, that all of us have this self-judgment. It's universal. And so I started studying shame and self-judgment. Like, what happens? What happens when I get mad at myself for eating unhealthy or not exercising enough or drinking too much or whatever it is that people were bringing up? And what the research shows, what the science shows, is that when you shame yourself, it shuts down the learning centers of the brain. It literally keeps us stuck in the very behaviors we're trying to change. So what I learned is shame doesn't work. And the surprising alternative is this attitude of kindness, that when we treat ourselves with kindness, it turns on the learning centers of the brain and gives us the resources we need to change. So mindfulness then is all three elements of intentionally paying attention with kindness.
Yeah, we'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
I love the way you describe that. And you talk a lot about rewiring and encoding joy and happiness practices into our brains, into our long-term memory. Can you give an example? Is this an imprinting on certain parts of our brain that move us into transformation or growth mindset or neuroplasticity? Is this what's happening here? Is that we're making this imprint?
I love that question. I think that's really important. So here's what I find very fascinating. So neuroplasticity, this is the ability of the brain to change between the ages of 0 and 25. It happens naturally. You can just walk through your life and your brain is learning and growing and changing. But right around age 25, not exactly on your birthday, but somewhere around there, the brain starts to become a little bit more fixed. And this makes sense because the design is we're learning some basic things like how to ride a bike and how to swallow food. And you don't want those to be always changing all the time. So what happens is after age 25, neuroplasticity is still possible, which is such a wonderful and hopeful message, but it takes actively engaging it. You can't just passively learn. And the way that you engage neuroplasticity is first, you have to set an intention. It has to be important to you. You can't just rest back on your laurels. You have to say, I want to change this. I want to learn this new language, or I want to learn this instrument. And so it has to be something meaningful, important. So that's the first step of neuroplasticity. That's also the first step of mindfulness. The second step of neuroplasticity is you have to be actively engaged. You have to be focused. You have to be paying attention. You cannot be just spacing out. It doesn't happen. And again, that's the second element of mindfulness, is paying attention. It trains you in how to do this. And third, neuroplasticity involves embracing errors and motivating yourself through positive self-talk, through encouragement. That's one of the best ways to engage neuroplasticity, is through recognizing that learning is a practice. It doesn't happen overnight. We make mistakes. In fact, the optimal learning rate is where you're making mistakes at about 15% of the time. And mindfulness teaches you how to bring this kindness and this compassion to yourself. And so what I found is that mindfulness actually is the superpower to actively engage neuroplasticity. And I believe that's one of the ways it's most transformational, is that mindfulness teaches you how to learn. And whatever you're bringing that superpower to, it's going to support you.
It's so interesting, because I remember either in an interview or somewhere in the book, you were talking about how there were some books that inspired you, but the practices are the things that really made the difference. And I think this is what happens as we get older, maybe past that 25 mark, where you're forced to do continual learning and practicing of different things. I think you start reading about things. If you feel depressed, you buy a book about depression. If you feel like you want more joy in your life, you buy a book about joy. And you're reading, but you're not necessarily, unless you decide to, as you would say, actively engage, you're not practicing. And is this what made all of the difference for you? And is this what you're describing as the science of neuroplasticity, really?
Exactly. And for me, as I said earlier, there's this phrase, what you practice grows stronger. And it's the simplest, clearest understanding of neuroplasticity. It's like you can read a menu, but it's not the same as eating the food. You can read about something, but until you actually engage your own neural pathways, they're not going to change. And no one can do it for you. No one can exercise for you. No one can meditate for you. No one can eat for you. No one can learn for you. And my book, Good Morning, I Love You, it was much more popular than we expected. I received hundreds and hundreds of emails and beautiful notes. And yet so many people said, well, now what? What do I do? How do I keep going? Like this whole book, and there are many, many practices in the book, but the focus of the book is really on the science and the story. And they said, I want support to keep going. And so that's why I created my new Good Morning, I Love You journal, which is a 3-month journey that takes people on daily practices to really support them in making these changes to rewire their mind for greater happiness, for greater peace, for better sleep. The only way to truly change is through practice.
Yeah. And you have said before that when you first learned loving kindness meditation, for example, you were a little bit resistant. I think you said it was too gooey. And here you've named your book, Good Morning, I Love You. And so how did you get past that feeling of this really works, pointing the lens inward with kindness like that?
Well, I'm so glad you're asking this because I think a lot of times people hear the title or they hear me speaking about it and they kind of roll their eyes like, oh, she's talking about self-compassion and loving kindness. And that's how I was at first too. And so I really understand. And the reason I named my book, Good Morning, I Love You, even though my publisher and everyone else said, don't do it because you're a scientist and everyone's going to think it's just all new agey and gooey. But the reason I did is because that single practice changed my life. And I learned it many years ago. I was going through a pretty difficult divorce. Our son was 3 years old and just a very terrible time to be getting divorced when you have a young child. And I remember waking up every morning with this pit of shame and fear and anxiety. How could I not have made this work? And here I am, a psychologist and a meditator, and just feeling this tremendous sense of shame. And my meditation teacher suggested I start a practice of loving kindness, of compassion. And she said, I want you to start saying, I love you, Shauna, every day. And I was like, no way. It just felt so inauthentic and so contrived. And it really wasn't how I was feeling. And she said, fine, how about just saying, good morning, Shauna. When you wake up, put your hand on your heart. It releases oxytocin, the hormone of love and safety. So it's good for you. And just say, good morning. And so the next morning, I resolutely put my hand on my heart. I took a breath and I said, good morning, Shauna. And it's kind of nice. Instead of the avalanche of fear and anxiety, there's this flash of kindness. And I kept practicing, and about a month or two went by, and it was my birthday. And I very clearly remember it because I was alone. My son was with his father, and they were at this long planned family reunion that I didn't go to. And so I woke up and put my hand on my heart to do my good morning, Shauna practice. And all of a sudden, this image of my grandmother, my Nana, came to me. And she had passed recently, and I loved her so dearly. And I just felt her love. And before I knew it, I said, good morning. I love you, Shauna. Happy birthday. And it was as if the dam around my heart burst and this love came pouring in, this love from my grandmother, from my mother, my own self-love. And I wish I could tell you every day since then has been this bubble of self-love, and that's not true. But the pathway was established. and it's continued to grow every day. And I have practiced every day since that moment, every morning, putting my hand on my heart and saying, good morning, I love you. And some days it feels awkward, and some days I feel nothing at all. But some days I feel this tremendous self-love. And for me, it's really changed my life. And that's why I titled my book, Good Morning, I Love You. I gave a TED Talk with Good Morning, I Love You in it, and have really tried to share this practice with as many people as possible.
Yeah, I think that's so great. And you talk about that idea of putting your hand on your heart when you wake up and it just bursting the dam around you and just flooding you with these feel-good emotions. What are some of the practices that you're most excited about in addition to that one? Which ones have had the biggest impact on you?
There's so many. But let's see. What I'll say is there's a couple really, for me, simple, powerful practices that I do every day. One of the practices is also a morning practice where I will ask. And the reason I started doing this is I started researching what's called the negativity bias. And the negativity bias is the tendency of the human brain to scan our environment for what is dangerous, what is negative, what is bad. And evolutionarily, this made sense. This was how we survived. We scanned our environment for danger and that protected us. But in our modern world, it's gotten a little askew, and it's important to counterbalance this negativity. So what I discovered is by waking up in the morning and orienting your mind towards, I wonder what surprising and beautiful thing will happen. What it does is it actually impacts the reticular activating system, which is the brain's filter. It's called the RAS. And it has it start to look for the good or the surprising. So let's say you become pregnant and all of a sudden you start noticing pregnant people everywhere. It's not that more people are pregnant. It's that your reticular activating systems has flagged pregnancy as important since you're pregnant. And that happens naturally, but we can also control it. And so by doing this morning practice, I tend to notice more beautiful things and more good things during the day. So that's a wonderful, simple practice that takes 10 seconds. Another practice related to this is a gratitude practice. And this I do every evening. And in fact, in the journal, there's a space every evening to write what you're grateful for. And your gratitude practice helps us orient our attention towards what we're grateful for. And the research behind gratitude is phenomenal. It improves your immune system, which I could use right now. A bit of a cold, as you can hear. It helps you sleep better. So I like to.
Hello, listeners. This is Michael from the Psychologists of the Clock podcast. If you like what you hear on Untangle, let me extend a friendly invitation to check out our show as well. We are four experts in psychology that bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health. You can find Psychologists of the Clock wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and you can visit our website at offtheclockpsych.com.
Do it at night, and it grows. Gratitude is something that, as you practice it, you become more oriented towards seeing what you're grateful for. So those are some of my favorite practices.
Yeah, it's funny you said those. I had written down the one about looking for surprises, because I think that's just such a lovely thing to do, to be on the lookout for what's surprising or even beautiful around you. So many people are talking about mindfulness, as you know, and you also brought up in your book some of the pitfalls of mindfulness, and that I think related to self-improvement versus self-liberation. Is that correct? And will you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. It's I think one of the greatest pitfalls or perils of meditation practice is thinking of it as another way to improve yourself. That when we get on this path, even if we have such good intentions, there's a way in which we can use meditation to beat ourselves up, to feel like I'm not good enough and I have to be better. And now, instead of trying to be prettier or thinner or make more money, which is our cultural norms of the right direction. Now we're trying to be more generous and more patient and more compassionate. And not that those are bad, but there's a way in which there's this lack of accepting ourselves, this way that we're constantly striving to be better instead of resting in the kindness and acceptance of who we are. And now that doesn't mean that we don't want to change. There's this wonderful quote from Suzuki Roshi, and he says, "You're perfect as you are, and there's room for improvement." That's where things are, is that there's this paradox where the goal is to be present and accept what is. And it helps us see clearly the areas that need some work, some practice. But we aren't meditating to try to make ourselves perfect. That's just exhausting. And it's a never-ending, ever-receding endpoint. So our intention is really, how do I be my best self while also loving myself exactly as I am, all at the same time? And to recognize that life is not meant to be a self-improvement project. It's meant to be lived.
I'm assuming that's why you believe that starting with self-compassion, even before mindfulness practices, self-compassion may be a mindfulness practice, but starting with self-compassion is so important.
It really is. And I think it's one of our Achilles heels. I think it's one of those things that people don't realize how important it is. And it's really challenging to get people to practice self-compassion. When I'm working with my clients and I bring up self-compassion, they kind of roll their eyes. They're like, "Oh no, you don't understand. I actually want to change. I'm actually trying to be a better parent. And if I'm compassionate with myself, I'm just going to keep yelling at my kids." And that's the crazy part of it, is that as we start to be kinder to ourselves, we start to change. It's the curious paradox that when I accept and love myself as I am, I change. And what the research shows, and the research on self-compassion is really profound, that people who are trying to exercise more or lose weight, or people who want to be more generous, loving spouses, what the research shows is that by being kind to themselves, paradoxically, it makes them more generous, more loving with their partners. By being kind to themselves, paradoxically, it helps them exercise more and eat healthier. And so self-compassion is really the first step to change.
Do you think that forgiveness as a practice or as an act maybe is a subset of self-compassion and compassion, depending on who we're forgiving?
I do think that forgiveness is a very important part of our psychological and spiritual work. I think it is very challenging and often misunderstood that forgiveness doesn't happen overnight. It's a long-term practice. And also that we're practicing not for the other person, but for ourselves. That forgiveness brings us peace. Forgiveness is what allows us to put down our burden of anger and resentment and pain. So forgiveness is a practice we do to free ourselves, to free our heart. And I think it's one of the most beautiful practices you can do.
Yeah. Living with resentment and blame is just such a heavy burden for people. When you look at the future, do you have a vision for how some of the mindfulness practices and the science, where this is all going as it relates to healthcare, hospitals, our educational systems, corporations? Do you think we're ready for this integration, and how will people learn these tools?
Absolutely. I think it's already happening. Time magazine had what was called the Mindful Revolution, and there's already 700 hospitals and medical centers around the country who've integrated mindfulness. It's being integrated in Fortune 500 companies, into our school systems, into the military. And I think right now, for me, the key is to keep doing the science so we understand how to best integrate it and how to best use it, and also to make these practices accessible, to demystify mindfulness, to help people understand that this is not a religious or spiritual practice, that it's really one of mental fitness, that we're training the mind. It's a universal human capacity. And I think what we want to better understand now are the nuances of how can we teach it in a way that's most effective for our children, for teachers, for patients, for parents, for politicians, that we need to find the ways that we can use mindfulness in our medical system, in our education system, in our society to help evolve us in the right direction of greater understanding of our interdependence, of our capacity for compassion and connection, so that we can really heal our world.
Yeah. I was speaking with someone yesterday and he had this great term when he said he was in a corporate environment. And he said, sometimes it just feels like there are spinning plates around you. And I had this image of the spinning plates from having been in a media company, from having been in a hospital, having pain, from having had tantrum as a child. There's so many spinning plates around us. Is it possible to pause and do a practice while the spinning plates are around you? For example, when you're in deep pain, when you can't sleep, when you are very angry in the moment, what are the in the moment practices that help us get through the intensity that makes it hard to do a mindfulness practice or even to meditate in silence when you're having all the spinning plates around you?
This is, I think, one of the most important dimensions of mindfulness is what I call the mindful pause in between the stimulus and response, in between that trigger and your automatic reaction. You have the chance to pause. And in that pause lies your freedom, that you don't have to automatically react. For me, the most powerful way is to just take a deep breath. That it's amazing what can happen in the time span of a long deep breath, where you come back to your center. And what you realize is once you react, you can't call those words or those actions home. You can repair them, but you can never call them home. And I think it's really one of the greatest benefits of mindfulness, where we can pause and not react. And I know we're close to out of time, but I want to end with a little story that for me is one of the most powerful demonstrations of this. So some years ago, as I mentioned, mindfulness has become quite popular. It's even made its way into the military. And there was a high-ranking official who had some anger management issues and was referred to a mindfulness training program to work on those. And when he arrived, he wasn't very excited to be there, but he actually really did want to work on his anger and set a very clear, very meaningful intention to learn how to manage it. So a couple of weeks into the program, he tells this story. He says he's at the grocery store. He has a cart full of groceries. He's just about to check out. And just before he enters the checkout lane, this elderly woman with a young baby girl steps in front of him. And he's kind of angry because she just stepped in front of him and cut a little bit. But he takes a breath and he remembers his intention and he sees she only has one small item, so it's no big deal. And he's able to calm down, doesn't react. But then this woman and the checkout clerk start like oohing and aahing over the baby. And all of a sudden she hands the baby girl to the checkout clerk for a hug and he almost explodes in anger. He's like, are you kidding? Is this a nursery? But luckily he takes a breath and he calms himself down. He remembers his intention to manage his anger. He takes another breath. And as he looks up, he sees that the little girl's pretty cute. An instant later, she's back in the arms of the woman. They walk out the door of the grocery store. And as the young checkout clerk is ringing up his groceries, he says to her, that little girl is pretty cute. And she looks up and she says, really, thank you. That's my daughter. And then she says, my husband died at war a few months ago, and I had to go back to work. And so my mom brings my daughter through my aisle every day for a hug.
Oh,
yeah. And you can feel in that moment how everything changes and how grateful he was for that pause, that instead of automatically reacting, he put himself back in choice. And that's really the power of mindfulness, is these little in-between moments where instead of being on automatic pilot, instead of just going through the motions of our life, we're back in choice and our natural wisdom and compassion can shine through.
I love that story. That is so beautiful. I'm going to ask you one small question before we close, because I think it's really important to what you're teaching. And you write about this in your book. It's the 5% principle.
Absolutely. So the 5% principle gets back to what we were talking about before with perfection isn't possible. And you don't want to be on this journey trying to do everything perfectly. It's about doing it 5% better. So this army official, he's never going to perfectly manage his anger, but could he do it 5% more? Could he interrupt the pattern? And so the key in change is to realize it's a practice and it's a process. And we just want to be moving in the right direction. And so the 5% principle is what I teach my students and my patients. And I say, just can you be 5% kinder to yourself? Or can you pause 5% more of the time? And just start to notice how these changes can begin to compound upon each other. And then there's this general movement in the right direction.
Perfection. Shauna, it's been so great chatting with you today. You have such great wisdom. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. And if anyone has any follow-up questions, please reach out on my website. I always respond. It's drshaunashapiro.com or on my Instagram account at drshaunashapiro.
Thank you. Take care of yourself.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us today. For more on Shauna, visit her website at drshaunashapiro.com. Her book is available at all major booksellers. And check out Muse at choosemuse.com when you have a minute. And if you have any questions or suggestions for us, as always, email us at untangle@choosemuse.com. Have a great week, and we will see you next time. We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.